FM is the Houston Pacifica station for peace and justice, showcasing independent music and news programming. This fall, KPFT is sponsoring a writing contest for Houston area community members. Entries will be judged by members of the KPFT local station board and then by a locally published Houston author. Poetry, fiction, and personal essays are welcome. The theme of our contest this fall is Welcome Home to Peace and Justice. Please submit pieces that somehow tie into any part or interpretation of that theme. For more information and contest rules, please go to kpft.org. You're listening to 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Tranquil Beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals it is once again Wednesday at 8 p.m. and time for So What's Your Story? We are the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's only here on 90.1 KPFT Houston. I'm your host tonight, Greg Audell, and along with a team saturated in talent, Drs. Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, and Hank Rubicek, our engineer and media relations scout, Tatiana Gago, and of course, Floyd the Wonder Dog, who is asleep in my lap. Together we bring you great storytellers, each and every week. Ordinary folks with extraordinary stories to tell, who take us on astonishing journeys through windows of their souls before bringing us safely and usually gently right back to the present. This is, without question, my favorite time of year, in large part because life and business just tends to slow down a little bit. Most folks are a wee bit friendlier, a little bit more thoughtful. But above all, the holidays gives us time to sit around with close friends and share stories. Some new, some favorites we want to hear again and again as we catch up, hopefully over hot chocolate and cookies. And that is what I'd like to do tonight. Mr. Rogers captured my feelings about the holidays perfectly when he said, "I like to compare the holiday season with the way a child listens to a favorite story. The pleasure is in the familiar way the story begins, the anticipation of familiar turns that it takes, and the familiar moments of suspense, and the familiar moments of climax and ending." Well, I've asked our very good friends, Harwood Taylor and Chris Gorman, to join us as we share some new stories and replay a couple of fan favorites from previous episodes, as well as a clip of Jonathan Winters reading A Christmas Carol, a treat that should not be lost to ours or future generations. Harwood Taylor is a member of the Houston Storytellers Guild and has been a friend of this program since 2009. Wow! He also hosts a popular breakfast club for storytellers. His stories have been recognized by both national and local audiences. One of his stories was featured on the National Moth Program this year, which is very cool. And when he's not telling stories, he is director of Grimion and Company Fine Art in Houston. Chris Gorman is a longtime member of the Houston Storytellers Guild and considers being a daydreamer that it is almost essential equipment. It's necessary, she says, for surviving 27 years in customer service. But big dreams helped her tell her first moth story, and she's been sharing stories ever since. She also loves encouraging her talented friend and nurturing her blind dog, Big Boy. We are a family of dog lovers here. Harwood and Chris, welcome once again to So What's Your Story? And thanks for joining me on this holiday week.
That's so good to be here.
Thanks for calling us, Greg.
Absolutely. It's just, I think that's what this week is for, is sitting around with friends. You've each had issues with New Year's Eve resolutions. Come on, we've all had issues with New Year's Eve resolutions. Chris, let's start the show off with your story.
Okay, well, you remember last year when everybody was kind of obsessed with the mural that went over the freeway, you know, the Be Someone? I was also obsessed with that, but maybe in a different way than some other people. I frankly found it a little accusatory. I had a little bit of an existential crisis about it. I thought, was I someone? Could I be a better someone? So I had to think about it, and I thought if I could change one thing about myself, maybe I could start being a runner. And I thought being a runner might be an easy way to kind of slide into a fitness practice. I mean, if it didn't work out, I could just say I'm going somewhere, but just a little faster than usual. So we started running. It's kind of weird that I would even think to do this, because when I was in school, I've had a note pretty much for my entire scholastic career that got me out of PE, because when I was in fourth grade, I sprained my ankle running in place. It surprised me. It surprised the coach. It surprised the nurse. And I was issued a note that pretty much let everyone know that I'd be better utilized at the library, which is probably still true. But anyway, we started running, me and my friend and the dog, on the bayou every morning. And one morning before we went to go run, he sent me an article that was from the science section of Huffington Post, which is where we get most of our breaking scientific news. And it said, hey, if you have the right outfit for a fitness activity, you are twice as likely to do the thing. And I was thinking, well, we can't argue with that because it's science. And why would you argue with science when it's essentially just telling you to go shopping? So we're like, yeah, we can take care of that. So we went straight over to TJ Maxx, which is where you get all your fine athletic apparel. And we both walk in, and he's a dude, so of course it takes like 5 minutes for him. Red, blue, black, shorts, shirt, he's done. Whereas I am lost in the ladies' athleisure section, I'm staring at this one thing that I've never bought before, and I'm kind of unmade. It's the sports bra. Okay, let me just clear this up for you. I have been wearing the lesbian version of a bra for 30 years, two shirts and a hoodie. I've even worn the more formal version of that, two shirts and a flannel. And I had been wearing a bra while we were doing this running down on the bayou, but I was wearing my weddings, courtroom, fancy bra, right? And 50% of this audience will understand this. This bra has an underwire in it, and you can start working out in an underwire bra. But about halfway through, it just feels like you're being very sexily and slowly mugged at knife point, okay? That wire will slide between your ribs like you would not believe it. Okay, so I'm sitting there, I'm staring at this thing, and I'm looking at them. They all seem a little controlling, like there's a lot of controlling going on, like a Gitmo level of control to these sports bras. And I'm looking at what I have upstairs, and I just need kind of like a distracted teenage mall cop level of control. These are, seem like overkill to me. Anyway, I grab three sizes because I just have no idea. And then I grab a pair of tights and I scuttle into the dressing room, right? So I lay them out. I pick the middle one because the three bears, right? And I try it on. I get it on some kind of way. And I'm like, wow, this is uncomfortable and extremely tight, which I found out later meant it fit perfectly, okay? And then I tried on the tights, which basically just showed every bite of food I had eaten since I was 3 years old. And then I stepped back, and I looked at myself in the long, full-length mirror, and I thought, wow, this is as Jackie Joyner Kersee as I am ever going to look. I even managed a small smile. And I was happy for a moment until I tried to take that thing off. Then all hell broke loose in there. I had both arms crossed in front of my face. This fabric, which was advertised as breathable, is not breathable when you're having a panic attack, thinking you're going to die in a TJ Maxx dressing room with your arms pinned behind your head. Okay? So I'm stuck like this, and I'm thinking, okay, what do I do now? Do I waddle back out to the front where you walk in and get the 12-year-old working behind the desk to pull the ripcord on this thing? I even had a moment where I thought maybe I could molt it off like a snake would shed its skin if I just kind of rolled around on the ground for a little while. But finally, I just solved it by kind of dislocating a shoulder for a moment, and I got out of it, and I bought it. And I have that outfit now, and when I have it on, people will come up to me and go, oh, do you work out? And I just want to say, no, I work in. a building where they pay me money and I get my 10,000 steps in just evading customers. Why would I pay money to go into a building to do more work? But I did it. I did it this year. I joined the Y. And let me just tell you, if you're thinking about starting a fitness practice or joining a gym this year, just remember, every time you go into a gym or a exercise place and you don't know what's going on, you're giving someone a gift. You're giving them the gift of being an expert. I had to ask so many people for help because I did not understand any of the things that were going on in there. I was looking for the emergency brake on the stationary bike. I thought I was dying slowly because I had confused the calorie counter with the heart rate on the treadmill. And my worst mistake was I thought that that swimsuit spinner that dries your swimsuit was actually a hydraulically powered Vitamix that they only would let the elite athletes use, okay? So just remember, every time you ask someone a question in there, all these people are there because they care about themselves, and they can share a little bit of that caring with you. And if all else fails, just go in there and act like a Mountain Dew up 8-year-old. Go in there and have a ball. Have fun and laugh, and you might accidentally get in shape, okay? So good luck to you, okay?
Chris, as great as that story is, now I wish we had video to go with it.
No, you don't. It was a debacle of major proportions. I'm scared already
well,
talking
clearly,
about it.
Well, clearly, your struggle is universal, but your take on it is uniquely Chris Gorman. What did you learn from this adventure or misadventure?
Things don't need to be that tight. That would be the first rule. And I guess what I learned was that everybody starts somewhere. You got to start somewhere. You're not going to be an expert right away. I had to let go of knowing everything before I started.
Well, hey, let me say, folks, as we always say on this program, that is absolutely true of public speaking, too. You know, you may not feel like a natural your first time, but if you just keep doing it, pretty soon it's going to be really comfortable to you.
I think that's true, Greg.
Me too.
You know, in our program's earlier years, Jay Staley was a fixture in this studio during the Christmas season. The story we're about to hear is one of his most moving. Hank, would you set the scene for this story, please?
Sure. Yeah, thanks for that opportunity, Greg. You know, the story is actually a simulation of what tonight is all about, family telling. This was not one of Jay's planned stories. As you pointed out, he's been on several times. This was from the December 23rd, 2011 program. You know, I asked him on the air after he told his planned stories, I asked him, you know, how is it that we should get started telling stories to our families? Because even though that's a fundamental question, you know, the idea of sitting around saying, hey, hi, Dad, you want to hear a story isn't quite what we had in mind. So I asked him, how do you get started? He says, well, you have to think of MIT, which is an acronym for most important thing, not the university. And the idea is, think about this one icon, this one symbol or signal that reminds you of an episode, a really focused episode. And I asked him, okay, have you got something in mind? And he said, my mother's ugly pink coffee mug. He says, just like that. And I said, what does that remind you of? He says, well, unfortunately, it was my mother's last Christmas. And I stopped him and I said, tell us the story. So this is what I would refer to as polished extemporaneousness. And it really demonstrates how stories should be told when you don't have a lot of time to think about it.
I was 21 in the fall, in October, when I was 21, my mother contracted meningitis, and I was living in New Mexico, and I came back to Columbus, Ohio, and when I arrived, she was in the hospital. She was in a coma. The doctors weren't real encouraged by the situation, and they were shocked when she came out of her coma after 7 days, and didn't give us a lot of hope about what might happen at that point. And it took my mother a long time to recover. She said things were jumbled up pretty well. I remember her when I asked her in the hospital where this problem began. She said it was in my east ear. And I said, in your east ear? And she said, well, maybe it was in my west ear. I can't remember. But the words and the descriptions and everything got jumbled up during the process of the coma. But in December, she finally got out of the hospital, and she got to come home for Christmas that year. And my brothers managed to get home as well. My brother Josh was 27 and I, Judd was 24. I was 21. And on Christmas morning, we put the burner under the coffee pot and got the coffee perking, and we woke our parents up and had sweet rolls, and we kind of spent some time over breakfast. We weren't so anxious to get under the tree and look at the presents that year. We were more inclined to rest and take some time and visit. And my father finally got up and went into the living room and plugged the lights in on the tree. And at that point, he was done with 8mm movies, and he was just taking still pictures with the 35mm camera. And he gave us the high sign, and my brother Josh stuck his head out of the door from the kitchen, and my brother Judd and I, and we jogged into our stockings as young adults and sat on the floor and opened up presents kind of casually. And at some point we turned our attention back to the kitchen, and a coffee cup appeared around the corner, and my mother came into the room and she sat down on the sofa. She took her spot there on the sofa and smiled at us. And all those years when we opened presents at Christmas, I'd look up at my mother on the sofa smiling at us as we tore open these packages. And I always wondered what she was smiling about, because she didn't have any presents. She wasn't opening presents yet. We were all opening our presents, but she looked so happy there on the couch. And it wasn't until that day when we were all adults and I looked up at my mom on the sofa and she was smiling, and I realized that the real gift to her was not anything that was under the tree. The real gift to her were the people that were in the room and the time that we spent together as a family around Christmas. And that year is when I realized that our real gift that year was the fact that we were all together and that my mother was with us. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we took our time opening presents, not because we were anxious to see what was in those packages, but because we wanted to extend that time together as much as we could at that point. So that was probably the Christmas when I realized that the real gift at Christmas is people. It's the time that you have and the time that you give. It's the attention that you give to people, the time you spend listening to their stories and telling stories and sharing stories.
Yes.
And the presents, the gifts, can sometimes be quite remarkable things, but they're not the most remarkable thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I was under the impression that he was older. That's another story, but still, you get the idea.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. Talk about a whole lot of messages in one very brief story. I've got goosebumps.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
Yeah. And it's so simple, you know, and I think we'd all agree we're all seasoned storytellers. And I think one thing that we agree on is that it's these simple stories that are the most poignant, you know. I mean, if when they're not muddy, they're not complicated, they're not clouded, they're so simple and coherent that they resonate.
Well, and they resonate. You're right, because with me, the ones that come deepest from my heart are the easiest to tell, even if they might be the most emotional. But they're also the ones where it's easiest to get the audience with you, because they can feel that genuine emotion.
Right.
You know, you're not trying.
Yeah.
Cried afterwards. He did cry. He wouldn't mind me.
No, I said try.
No, I'm saying he cried.
I bet.
He did. No, he cried after that story.
I bet.
I'm sure he wouldn't mind me telling you that. And yeah, it's just remarkable. Again, it's the simplicity that knocks me out.
Well, and like any good story, I'm pretty sure that this is one I'm going to be thinking about tomorrow.
Me too.
You know?
Me too. I just was watching my nephews unwrap gifts, my great nephews. And it is cool to think, what are they thinking?
Oh, yeah. Well, for me, one thing that is sometimes hard with little kids and Christmas is watching them and thinking they think this is how it's always going to be. Right. They don't realize how families change. And
yeah, that's right.
You know,
that this is. Yeah.
But
I think I know what he was thinking. He was thinking Transformers. Yeah. This is so cool. I was thinking the same thing.
Now, Harwood, you've had your own battles with New Year's resolutions, I understand. Will you tell us that story?
Sure. This is sort of adapted for a New Year's resolution purpose. So it's hard to total a Volvo station wagon. First of all, the kind of person that buys a Volvo station wagon, probably a pretty careful driver. I wasn't that guy. About 20 years ago, people that knew me knew that I drove a blue Volvo station wagon, that I loved snacks, and I love all kinds. I love salty snacks, so I love, you know, chips and popcorn, but I also love sugar. I love, you know, donuts and cookies and candy and all of it. And on this particular day, I was driving down West Alabama, and I was medicating some sadness with three of my favorites, some artisanally grown and I'm sure lovingly prepared white chocolate macadamia nut cookies. Yeah, some fresh Krispy Kreme donuts, 12 of them, and some factory made double stuff Oreos. I had them all open. They were on the seat next to me. They were all going in the corpus. They were going in my mouth. I was driving, and I was about to make an illegal left turn. I'd made this confidently many times, this illegal left turn. It was my own personal, you know, kind of protest about the fact that there should have been a light at West Alabama and Kirby, which there is now, but I was ahead of my time. Anyway, and what you do, obviously, is you just sit in the middle of the intersection, wait for the last car to come, and then you go. And usually the light's red. Well, in this case, the last car went, and there was another one coming, but I could see the hood going down, and so the car was slowing. So naturally, I assumed the car was going to stop. So I kind of punched it, and so did she. Next thing I know, I'm in a head-on accident, and I'm in a centrifuge of sugar. There is donuts and double stuffed cookies and stuff bouncing off every surface. The thing spun two times. I even had time, you know how things slow down, to think, wow, I'm going to be found dead with a Krispy Kreme donut, a fresh one, jammed right up my nose cavity from the airbag going off. But that's not what happened. Neither of us died. Both of our airbags went off and we were fine. And then there was the cop there saying, you know, well, tell me what happened. And I said, well, I ran a red light and I caused the accident. And he puts his pad down. He looks at me and he says, what? And I said, I know, I shouldn't have. I mean, he goes, no, stop. He said, it's so startling that you told the truth. No one ever tells the truth. And so I was telling the truth about that accident. But what I wasn't telling the truth about, and what really could kill me, was my eating habits. And it woke me up, you know, to kind of look in that totaled car with all those cookies and donuts and everything all over the place. And like, wow, something needs to change. So I did, you know, over time, took a year or so. I slowly lost the weight and started to exercise, and, you know, I got better. But now it's 10 years later, which is still 10 years ago. This original part happened 20 years ago. I'm driving down I-10. It's 2:00. I haven't had anything to eat. My car's also running out of gas. And I stop at this convenience store, gas station, and, I'm filling up, and over the gas station pump, I see the siren song of junk food calling, and it's in the form of a beautiful backlit photograph of nachos. Now, we all know that gas station nachos are not going to look like that photograph. I know that, but I want the nachos that are coming out of that grody machine at this point. And so I go in and I open the plastic bag. I pour them into this little paper dish, and underneath that beautiful photograph of the nachos, there's a orange, or I'll say a cheese colored button, and you put the little thing, hold it under there, and you push with your thumb, and nothing happens. And I'm like, okay, that's a sign, that's good. And immediately I hear the cash register close, and the guy behind me saying, excuse me, sir, I'll get right on that. He zips around the counter, goes into the back. He comes back with a full square bag that looks like an IV bag of cheese. And he opens up, apparently that photograph is actually a spring door, and he opens the spring door, and there's an empty cheese-looking IV bag in there. So he pulls that out, puts the other IV bag in. I do not want these nachos anymore. And he goes, there you go, you know, and he races back. And then so I just think, well, I'm going to buy them, and I'll throw them away when the guy can't see me out by my car. And so I go to push the button again. It doesn't work again. I think, okay, there's a God. I'm not supposed to have this. And I hear him say, oh, I forgot something. So he zips around the corner, you know, the counter again. And in one motion, he just comes over and he jams his finger right up into the cheese hole. He pulls it out, wipes it off. He's done this before. This is not his first cheese hole rodeo. And he takes his thumb and he pushes the cheese colored button. The cheese comes out in a, you know, empty tray, and he goes, "There you go." And I just, you know, I said, "Thank you." But inside, I'm just screaming the whole time, "No!" You know, he really did this. And I just thought, I can't tell this guy, because he's, you know, this guy has been trained. I mean, he did this so skillfully. And so I thought, again, I'm just going to buy them and I'll throw them away out by the car. So I bought them and I walk out to the car, and the trash can's right there by the gas pump. And this is where I want to lie to you. I want to tell you I threw them away, but I didn't. I ate them. I ate all of them, and I loved it. And so here's the thing. You know, we're all going to make, well, some of us are going to make New Year's resolutions. You don't have to do the right thing all the time. Just most of the time.
Oh, I think that's a good rule for life.
Yeah, I do too.
A friend of mine, I think, quoted Aeschylus, who said, everything in moderation, including moderation.
I like that. Aeschylus.
Now, what I took from your story is, had you died in the car accident, at least you would have died happy on a sugar buzz. That's what I took from the story.
I thought about that too, right. And, you know, thinking I was getting away with something.
But let me ask you, in case that's not the message you wish to convey, what would you like the listener to take away from this story?
You know, for me, it was just a fun thing that happened. But, you know, gosh, I go to the Y with Chris here and in the mornings. Do that. Do whatever that is that you know, makes you happy. But I'm almost positive it's science. You got to exercise or to be happy.
Yeah. You know, I took away another message from this story. I hope never to consume cheese that comes out of a hole. That's what I took away from your story.
Good point. Good point.
That's good.
You know, I think it's an absolute tragedy that the most memorable performances of the world's great talents often fade from the common memory and are lost to future generations. I mean, I'm fortunate. I saw Sinatra, Bob Hope, Ella Fitzgerald, Ray Charles, Phyllis Diller, you know, and I urge people to take young kids to these older performers because it's something they'll remember the rest of their life. So from time to time, we feature storytellers on this program whose lives have ended, but with our help, their stories continue. Tonight, we're going to spend a few minutes with the brilliant Jonathan Winters reading Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol.
Of all the good days in the year on Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house. It was a cold, bleak, biting, foggy weather, and the city clocks had only just gone 3, but it was quite dark already. The door of Scrooge's counting house was open that he might keep his eye upon his clerk, who in a dismal little cell beyond, a sort of tank, was copying letters. Scrooge had a very small fire, but the clerk's fire was so very much smaller that it looked like one coal, but he couldn't replenish it, for Scrooge kept his coal box in his own room. Wherefore the clerk put on his white comforter, tried to warm himself at the candle, in which effort, not being a man of strong imagination, he failed.
A Merry Christmas, Uncle! God save you!
It was a cheerful voice, the voice of Scrooge's nephew, who came upon him so quickly that this was the first intimation he had of his approach.
Bah! Humbug! Christmas a humbug, Uncle? You don't mean that, I'm sure.
I do. Merry Christmas! What right have you to be merry? What reason have you to be merry? You're poor enough.
What right have you to be dismal? What reason have you to be morose? You're rich enough.
Bah! Humbug!
Don't be cross, Uncle.
What else can I be when I live in such a world of fools as this? Merry Christmas. Out upon Merry Christmas. What's Christmas time to you but a time for finding yourself a year older and not an hour richer? If I could work my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart. He should.
Uncle.
Nephew, Keep Christmas in your own way, and let me keep it in mine.
Keep it? But you don't keep it.
Let me leave it alone, then. Much good may it do you, much good it has ever done you.
There are many things from which I might have derived good, by which I have not profited. I dare say Christmas among the rest. I have always thought of Christmas time as a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time, and I say, God bless it.
The clerk in the tank involuntarily applauded.
Let me hear another sound from you, and you'll keep your Christmas by losing your situation.
You're quite a powerful speaker, sir.
I wonder you don't go into Parliament.
Don't be angry, Uncle. Come. Dine with us tomorrow.
Scrooge said that he would see him. Yes, indeed he did. He went the whole length of the expression and said that he would see him in that extremity first.
But why? Why?
Why did you get married?
Because I fell in love.
Because you fell in love? Good afternoon.
I want nothing from you. I ask nothing of you. Why cannot we be friends?
Good afternoon.
I'm sorry, with all my heart, to find you so resolute. We have never had any quarrel to which I have been a party. But I've made the trial in homage to Christmas, and I'll keep my Christmas humor to the last. So a Merry Christmas, Uncle.
Good afternoon.
And a Happy New Year.
Good afternoon.
The clerk, in letting Scrooge's nephew out, had let another person in. He was a portly gentleman, pleasant to behold, and stood with his hat off in Scrooge's office. He had books and papers in his hands, and bowed to him.
Scrooge and Marley's, I believe. Have I the pleasure of addressing Mr. Scrooge or Mr. Marley?
Mr. Marley has been dead these 7 years. He died 7 years ago this very night.
At this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge, it is more than usually desirable that we should make some slight provision for the poor and destitute, who suffer greatly at the present time.
Are there no prisons?
Plenty of prisons, but under the impression that they scarcely furnish Christian cheer of mind or body to the unoffending multitude. A few of us are endeavoring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth. We chose this time because it was a time of all others when want is keenly felt and abundance rejoices. What shall I put you down for, sir?
Nothing.
You wish to be anonymous.
I wish to be left alone. Since you ask me what I wish, that is my answer. I don't make merry myself at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. I have to support the prisons and the workhouses. They cost enough, and those who are badly off must go there.
Many can't go there, and many would rather die.
If they would rather die, they had better do it, and decrease the surplus population. Good afternoon, sir.
Seeing clearly that it would be useless to pursue his...
What a talent. What an incredible talent. Yeah. Let me ask each of you, what was going through your mind while you were listening to that story?
Gosh, I was just thinking that. I'm just thinking how grateful I am that not only, you know, he was this wonderful comedian, but I'm just so grateful that someone recorded it and that we get to hear it these years later. And we don't, you know, I guess... You know, long ago storytelling wasn't recorded and we lost those voices, you know.
Absolutely. Well, that's why I give you my word. I'm going to try and bring more, you know, these classics to air. And if you liked it, you know, just go to YouTube. You can listen to the whole story. I've listened to it about 5 times the last 3 days.
Cool.
What do you think, Chris?
I remember watching Jonathan Winters on Mork and Mindy.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he was good on Mork and Mindy.
He was their baby, wasn't he?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I kind of miss that show.
But wait a minute, Chris, you've got to do your line. She was in A Christmas Carol.
Oh, I was in A Christmas Carol when I
Boy,
was a kid.
Would you go get that turkey down the way?
You mean that one as big as me? That was
oh,
my line.
Very nice. I like it. I like it. Unfortunately, you know, the thing I also listen in just listening to the classic story is I'm afraid there are millions and millions of our fellow citizens who kind of agree with Scrooge.
Yeah,
that's sort of the heartbreaking message to me. Well, friends, this is Greg Audell, and I am here with Tatiana Gago running our board. And you are enjoying Holiday Stories with my guest tellers, Harwood Taylor and Chris Gorman, on So What's Your Story? On Houston's KPFT 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.3 for our friends in Livingston. Now, Tatiana, what can our listeners expect when it comes to storytelling in Houston?
Well, let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. The Guild sponsors all sorts of events, so be sure to visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for information about all of the great stuff that they do. And while you're checking things out on the Guild's page, listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008, all listed on the menu under Radio Program. There are well over 400 of them, so you better get started. And if you don't own a radio, that's no problem, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and on our Facebook Live. Visit us on our So What's Your Story Facebook page and share with all of your friends. We'd love it if you like us when you leave. So What's Your Story is also on YouTube, so come to think of it, we're all over the place. And remember our friends at the Moth at Warehouse Live, the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy dazzling stories and get acquainted with Houston's storytelling community. Next one is Tuesday, January 8th, and the theme is Intentions. I guarantee if you like hearing good stories, this will become one of your favorite monthly events.
I know I'm going to be there. How about you, Harwood and Chris? Yeah,
absolutely. Planning on being there. That's my intent.
And let me say, you know, when we talk about all the great stuff the Guild does, you know, they also sponsor a bunch of workshops. I believe they're working with the Institute of the Women's Institute of Houston on a number of workshops that you can check out on their website, Houston Storytellers.
Yeah, Greg, I'm sorry. Greg?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a workshop. It's a class that I'm teaching at the Women's Institute.
Oh.
So we just kind of dropped that because it was a little bit, yeah. It's a class that I'm teaching. It's the first three Mondays of February. And I'd love it. People can register. It's for personal telling. It's a beginning class, but it's going to be more of a seminar than a class, that's for sure. It's limited enrollment to 14. And it'll meet the first three Mondays of February from 1 to 3 in the afternoon. And registration is open. You can do it online or you can give them a call.
Well, all right. Well, thank you for that clarification. And, you know, I just recommend you go to the Houston Storytellers Guild site every now and then because they're always doing something interesting. And, you know, you might want to check out their monthly event if you enjoy storytelling and want to explore that inner storyteller you have inside of you. The Guild is a great place to start. You'll meet a good, encouraging group of storytellers of all experience levels, from novice to professional. Well, thank you, Tatiana, and thank you, Dr. Hank. The toughest part of each year ending is reflecting back on those we lost. The station lost one of its pioneers and loudest cheerleaders when we lost Ray Hill a few weeks ago. This program and I both lost a dear friend when former Miss Universe Chelsea Smith, my guest on October 6, 2016, lost her battle with cancer in September. And the nation lost a respected leader, and Houston lost a friend and champion when we lost former President George H.W. Bush in November. I was fortunate to have had a number of encounters with President and Mrs. Bush, and I wrote a piece for the Houston Chronicle that ran December 7th, the week of his funeral. And I'd like to share part of it with you now. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but if you'd like to read the full story, you can find it online by searching George H.W. Bush and Me, the Kid in the Green Suit. I was in junior high during the 1980 presidential election when I wrote to Ambassador George H.W. Bush's office and asked for an interview with him. His assistant, Shirley Green, a very nice lady, called and said an interview would not be possible, but asked if I wanted to spend Election Day with the press and the Bushes. Well, of course I did. The night before the election, my father bought me a green suit for $30 from Wiener's. Election Day started around 6 a.m. at the Westin Galleria when I loaded onto a bus with the national press that took us to a local YMCA to observe George and Barbara Bush voting. We then went back to the hotel, where the Bushes hosted a breakfast for the press, who'd been traveling with them for many months. What I remember most was a lot of laughter and even a few tears. It was clear that Bush had genuine affection and respect for the press. What a different era. Next, we were taken to the Bushes' home. While Ambassador and Mrs. Bush were inside, some of the Bush sons and the press played football. Most had a change of clothing with them. I, however, played in my green suit. As a passionate Democrat, even at 13, that evening I was horrified as I was watching the hotel ballroom fill up with extremely happy Republicans. So I left the ballroom, and in a hallway I saw George Bush's brother getting into an elevator. So I jumped in, turned on my recorder, and started asking questions, which he was happy to answer. Now, the funny thing is, a year later, I was at my brand new high school talking to my buddy Alex, and we discovered that we had both been at that event that night. And he told me, "I even got in the elevator with Bush's brother, but I didn't get to talk to him because there was some obnoxious kid in a green suit who wouldn't let anyone else talk." I said, "I wasn't being obnoxious. I was interviewing him. That's what I was there for." We still laugh about that to this day. He still says I was obnoxious. At some point that evening, we were told that five members of the press would be allowed into the Bush's suite at a time for a few minutes to observe the family and take pictures. Well, upon entering the suite, I thought, since there were a lot of people coming in and out, I was the only one of the few kids. If I took off my press credentials, I'd just look like someone's kid who was supposed to be there. And it worked. I spent the rest of the evening in the Bush's suite with them. When it became clear the Reagan and Bush ticket was going to defeat Carter Mondale, I was completely heartbroken. As tears welled up in my eyes, a very kind and very young Laura Bush asked me what was wrong. I was honest. I said, "I'm a Democrat and Jimmy Carter's a friend of mine." She looked at me with the eyes of a teacher and said sweetly, "I was a Democrat when I married into this family. Politics is tough, and your team's going to win again another day. And you're going to do your part to help them do it. Just didn't go your way today." Well, whenever I see or hear of Laura Bush, I remember her for taking the time to be kind to a sad kid when she didn't need to be. A few weeks later, Barbara Bush agreed to give me an interview about her very brand new life. She said it was embarrassing to have men with guns follow her everywhere she went, and she didn't appreciate that Christmas gifts she'd bought for family had somehow leaked in the newspapers. She also told me that she had just come back from D.C., where she'd gone to a reception at Ford's Theater. As she took her seat on stage, everyone rose and applauded. So she did what she'd done her whole life. She stood and applauded, and she leaned over to the woman next to her and said, "Who are we clapping for?" She was stunned when the woman replied, "You." She told me, "That is going to take some getting used to." You know, I am sure that a couple weeks before Christmas and a few weeks after her husband had been elected Vice President of the United States of America, there were endless demands on her time. But she saw the value of giving a local kid who was bold enough to ask a glimpse into history in the making. 8 years later, I had an internship in Washington, D.C., and attended Sunday services at the Episcopal Church near my apartment, which was St. John's, known as the President's Church, because every president since 1816 had attended at least one service there. One Sunday morning, shortly after Vice President Bush became President-elect Bush, a few minutes into the service, I heard helicopters overhead and a lot of commotion outside. Soon, the President-elect and Mrs. Bush walked in with their two young granddaughters. The President's pew, number 54, had a plaque on it. So, of course, I always sat behind it, hoping they would come in. As the Bushes settled down in front of me, I watched them try and keep the girls squirming. Mrs. Bush passed candy to her husband, and they seemed like just any other family. When they went to the altar for communion, I slipped a note where the President-elect was sitting, telling him I was a fellow Houstonian, had watched the 1980 election results in his suite, and asked him to call me. A few nights later, I was in the shower when my roommate walked in the bathroom holding the phone. He said, "Why is George Bush calling you?" I actually thought he probably would call. I just didn't expect it at that exact moment. I grabbed the phone. I heard him say, "Greg, I want to thank you for slipping me a note at church the other day. People don't slip me notes very often, so I thought I'd give you a call. And I have a question for you. Are you the kid in the green suit who was in our suite election night 1980? I said, yes, sir, I absolutely was. He said, you know, you're in lots of pictures, but we have never figured out who you were. Well, I was lucky to have a number of encounters with the Bushes. I'm amazed that I was able to be with them the first night he was elected Vice President of the United States. And the day he left the presidency, even though I'd been a hardcore Bill Clinton volunteer and was thrilled by his victory, I went to Ellington Field on January 20th when President Bush, now former President Bush, flew back into Houston. I wanted to shake his hand and thank him for his service, which was sincere. And I remembered the words of Congressman George Bush, who went to greet LBJ the day he left the White House, January 20th, 1969. He said, when a president of the United States from Texas is at the airport, you show up. So I'd like to tip my hat to the Bushes for giving this kid a glimpse into the world and a glimpse into just what kind people they truly were.
What a wonderful stalker you were. Such a such a precocious young one, too.
I think I learned at a long age, if you wanted exciting things to happen to you, you had to make them happen.
Yeah.
That's a good moral.
I still try and do that, but I leave the stalking out of the equation. You know?
When you were talking about riding the bus over to the event, they had a really nice thing on Facebook from Metro interviewing people on the Metro going to the funeral and to the viewing of his body. And people were very excited to go show their appreciation for him and also just to be on the bus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seriously. Yeah,
on the bus is always a pretty cool place to be.
Right?
Next week, my friends, Warren Holloman will be our host. And he will launch the new year with a type of story we premiered last year with incredible results and a lot of great feedback. Opera with St. John Flynn and Eric Skelly of the Opera Cheat Sheet podcast. Now, I'd like to play one more story from one of the greatest storytellers to have ever lived. Mark Twain wrote a letter from Santa Claus to his daughter, Susie Clemens, and it's a story that deserves to be remembered. Tatiana?
Ballads of St. Nicholas and the Moon, Christmas Morning. My dear Susie Clemens, I've received and read all the letters which you and your little sister have written me by the hand of your mother and your nurses. I've also read those which you little people have written me with your own hands, for although you did not use any characters that are in grown people's alphabet, you use the characters that all children in all lands on earth and in the twinkling stars use. And as all my subjects in the moon are children and use no character but that, you will easily understand that I can read your and your baby sister's jagged and fantastic marks without any trouble at all. But I had trouble with those letters which you dictated through your mother and the nurses, for I am a foreigner. I cannot read English writing well. You will find that I made no mistakes about the things which you and the baby ordered in your own letters. I went down your chimney at midnight when you were asleep and delivered them all myself, and kissed both of you too, because you are good children, well-trained, nice-mannered, and about the most obedient little people I ever saw. But in the letter which you dictated, there were some words which I could not make out for certain, and one or two small orders which I could not fill, because we ran out of stock. Our last lot of kitchen furniture for dolls has just gone to a very poor little child in the North Star, away up, in the cold country, above the Big Dipper. Your mamma can show you that star, and you will say, Little Snowflake, for that is the child's name. I'm glad that you got furniture, for you need it more than I. That is, you must write that with your own hand, and Snowflake will write you an answer. If you only spoke it, she wouldn't hear you. Make your letter light, and thin, for the distance is great and the postage very heavy. There was a word or two in your mamma's letter which I couldn't be certain of. I took it to be a trunk full of dolls' clothes. Is that it? I will call at your kitchen door about 9 o'clock this morning to inquire. But I must not see anybody, and I must not speak to anybody but you. When the kitchen doorbell rings, George must be blindfolded and sent to open the door. Then he must go back to the dining room, or the china closet, and take the cook with him. You must tell George He must walk on tiptoe and not speak. Otherwise he will die some day. Then you must go up to the nursery and stand on a chair or the nurse's bed and put your ear to the speaking tube that leads down to the kitchen. And when I whistle through it, you must speak in the tube and say, "Welcome, Santa Claus." Then I will ask whether it was a chunk you ordered or not. If you say it was, I shall ask you what colour you want the chunk to be. Your mamma will help you to name a nice colour. And then you must tell me every single thing in detail which you want the trunk to contain. Then when I say goodbye and a Merry Christmas to my little Susie Clemens, you must say, "Goodbye, good old Santa Claus. I thank you very much, and please tell that little snowflake I will look out for her star tonight, and she must look down here. I will be right in the West Bay window. And every fine night I will look at her star and say, 'I know somebody up there, and like her too.' Then you must go down into the library and make George close all the doors that open into the main hall, and everybody must keep still for a little while. I will go to the moon and get those things, and in a few minutes I will come down the chimney that belongs to the fireplace that is in the hall, if it is a trunk you want, because I couldn't get such a thing as a trunk down the nursery chimney, you know. People may talk if they want, until they hear my footsteps in the hall. Then you tell them to keep quiet a little while, till I go back up the chimney. Maybe you will not hear my footsteps at all, so you may go down now and then and peep through the dining-room doors, and by you will see that thing which you want, right under the piano in the drawing-room, for I shall put it there. If I should leave any snow in the hall, you must tell George to sweep it into the fireplace, for I haven't time to do such things. Oh, George must not use a broom but a rag, else he will die some day. You must watch George and not let him run into danger. If my boot should leave a stain on the marble, George must not holystone it away. Leave it there always in memory of my visit. And whenever you look at it, or share it to anybody, you must let it remind you to be a good little girl. Whenever you are naughty and somebody points to that mark which your good old Santa Claus's boot made on the marble, what will you say, little sweetheart? Goodbye for a few minutes, till I come down to the world and ring the kitchen doorbell. Your loving Santa Claus, who people sometimes call the Man in the Moon.
Well, one reason why we put this at the end is nobody wants to follow Mark Twain, and the only one who can do it is our own Dr. Hank, who has a special story.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
children's story.
Follow Mark. I do it all the time. This is great stuff tonight, Greg. Really, really wonderful stuff, and perfect story. Perfect stories. Thank you, Chris, Harwood. You guys are great, really. And that was a great story by Mark Twain. And you know, Mark Twain is the consummate humorist, and that's what you need this time of year more than anything else. And, you know, Greg, the stories that we heard tonight, including your piece about meeting President Bush, was really poignant. It really punctuated the meaning of others. And that just about the most important message of the season is caring about others. But, you know, there's something else that we all need, and that's a sense of self, who we are. The old adage, love yourself to love another, is true. And it might be nice to remind ourselves that each of us is a gift. A couple of days before our grandson Jack was born, Peggy bought the book On the Night You Were Born by award-winning children's author Nancy Tillman. I know many of our listeners know this, and I inscribed it with a personal message to Jack, and that he is a gift. And I'd like to share the story with our listeners. On the night you were born, the moon smiled with such wonder that the stars peeked in to see you, and the night wind whispered, "Life will never be the same, because there had never been anyone like you ever in the world." So enchanted with you were the wind and the rain that they whispered the sound of your wonderful name. The sound of your name is a magical one. And let's say it out loud before we go on. Harwood. It sailed through the farmland high on the breeze and over the ocean and through the trees until everyone heard it and everyone knew of the one and only ever you. Not once had there been such eyes, such a nose, such silly, wiggly, wonderful toes. In fact, I think I'll count to three so you can wiggle your toes for me. When the polar bears heard, they danced until dawn. From faraway places, the geese flew home. The moon stayed up until morning next day. And none of the ladybugs flew away. So whenever you doubt just how special you are, and you wonder who loves you, how much and how far, listen for geese honking high in the sky. They're singing a song to remember you by. And notice the bears asleep at the zoo. It's because they've been dancing all night just for you. Mm-hmm. Or drift off to sleep to the sound of the wind. Listen closely. It's whispering your name again. If the moon stays up until morning one day, or a ladybug lands and decides to stay, or a little bird sits at your window a while, it's because they're all hoping to see you smile. For never before, in story or rhyme, not even once upon a time, has the world ever known a you, my friend, and it never will, not ever again. Heaven blew every trumpet and played every horn on the wonderful, marvelous night you were born.
What a beautiful story. Wow. Thank you, Hank.
Thank you for the opportunity. I think all of us need to know that we have to love each other and we have to love ourselves. Everybody is so incredibly special. And I know that one of the things that I want this year is for all of my friends to know how much I love them. I try very hard to let them know that, but I always work very hard to make sure that my friends know how much I love them. They matter.
I think we all fall into a trap of, I don't know, somehow it gets easier to notice people's faults and defects instead of their amazing uniqueness, you know, and we gloss over the good stuff. And we just focus on the bad stuff, and we got that completely backwards.
Yeah, well, your good stuff is showing. All of your good stuff is showing tonight.
Kind of you to say. Well, I want to thank Harwood Taylor, Chris Gorman, Dr. Hank Rubicek, Jay Staley, the late Jonathan Winters, and the allegedly late Mark Twain for sharing holiday stories with us. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, and I hope you have a wonderful new year, my friends. Here's to working hard to make 2019 everything we want it to be for ourselves, for those we love, and even those we encounter. Don't you dare move, friends, because Flash Gordon Parks is up next. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us each and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? Treasure what you hear. And don't be afraid to share your own stories. You keep loving great stories, and we will keep bringing them to you. This is Greg Audell, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is absolutely never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.
Listener support is the largest source of funding for the high-quality KPFT programs and content you've come to expect on your radio at kpft.org, on your phone, tablet, or smart speaker. Your tax-deductible year-end gift today affirms your commitment to KPFT's strong, independent community radio service. Give now.
Your support is essential at kpft.org. We look to you to support radio programming that you value on KPFT. KPFT is a dependable source of news and music here for you every day, and listener contributions are the largest and most important source of funding for KPFT. So please give a year-end gift to the station by going to kpft.org. Thank you. This is KPFT Houston.